Hello and welcome to today's Hospice News Elevate podcast. My name is Jim Parker. I'm senior editor of Hospice News. And with me is Margot Lambright, Division Director for Psychosocial Support at Biota Hospice. Margot and I are going to be talking about the ways that psychosocial teams identify families at higher emotional risk, as well as practical strategies for implementing and documenting supportive interventions. Margot, thanks so much for being here. We really appreciate it.
My pleasure. I'm happy to be here.
So we're here to talk about a very serious issue that is near and dear to my heart as well, and that's family caregiving. I know growing up, my mother was a caregiver in our home for my grandmother who had dementia, and I've been a caregiver for my brother who had congestive heart failure. So I'm really looking forward to this conversation. I wanted to start by asking, I'm sure many of our listeners have some idea of this, but for the purposes of this discussion, what are some of the many challenges that a family faces when a loved one has a serious or terminal illness?
Yeah, so a serious illness can destabilize a family system. You know, a family unit that is fully functioning can be, for lack of a better term, torn apart when a serious illness or hospice even is thrown into that mix. And so some of the challenges that we see patients and their families facing are emotional challenges such as anticipatory grief, fear, guilt, anger, and even the uncertainty about what's ahead. And another big one is role changes. So when adult children become caregivers, when spouses take on new roles and responsibilities, things that we didn't think we'd ever be doing, it really challenges us as humans and in our relationships. Practical challenges such as managing complex care needs at home, coordinating schedules, juggling work, financial strain. You know, a lot of times we have family caregivers who will take a leave of absence from work, FMLA work, and that's not always guaranteed paid leave. And so we see a lot of families going through financial strain as well. And then there's the spiritual and existential crises that we go through, you know, questions about meaning and purpose and unfinished business. It can also be conflicts between spiritual beliefs and medical decisions. And so we see a lot of those come up when we've got serious illnesses in the picture. Probably one of the bigger ones, I'd say, is communication challenges. So whether that's difficulty in processing the prognosis or understanding the prognosis, difficulty completing advanced directives or understanding what the patient truly wants or wanted, and the uneven flow of information among family members. So oftentimes a healthcare system will ask for one spokesperson to be the contact, and that information then gets disseminated down to other family members. And it's up to that family to decide how they disseminate that information. And so sometimes there are communication challenges that arise when we're dealing with serious illness.
I see. And this question is just occurring to me, but are families also kind of being required to perform more kind of relatively complex medical services for their loved ones? I remember near the end of my mother's life, I had to give her infusions, and I found a bag of infusion supplies at the doorstep that had been delivered. I had thoughts like someone was going to come in and do that, and I had to watch YouTube videos to figure out how to do it. Which was kind of nerve-wracking. So is that a common experience for families?
It is. You know, as healthcare advances, we are using trickier and more complex life-sustaining treatment measures, which means that we have the option to keep people comfortable and sustained for longer, which is why our life expectancy goes up. But it also means that, we're not going to keep somebody in the hospital for an infusion when we can send them home and train their family members. Mm-hmm. Now, it's up to that agency who's providing those supplies to train the family members. But like you said, a lot of times we don't receive that training. And there are, you know, as scary as it sounds, there are YouTube videos that do teach us how to do sort of, you know, things like that. But yes, doing medical procedures that you never thought you would have to do is definitely a huge component to caregiver stress. Within our practice here, we have a pediatrics division, and we have family members who are caring for a child with a tracheostomy or a ventilator, things that they never thought they would have to do. And it's kind of that, you know, you don't know what you're going to face until you're up against it, and you sink or swim, and you know, most people swim with that. They learn how to do it, they adapt, and they adjust to that new role, but it doesn't make it any easier.
See, thank you. And are some families at higher risk than others? What are some of the contributing factors to that risk, if so?
Absolutely. So certain families are predictably more vulnerable based on their socioeconomic background, their racial, ethnic background. When we're talking about serious illness, there are a number of risk factors that come to mind. And so one could be the history of mental health conditions. So whether that be the mental health condition of the patient or the caregiver, if we've got family conflict or trauma that can be brought up, I always say that serious illness and death can bring out the worst in people, but it can also bring out the best in people. And so sometimes we see these longstanding conflicts that bubble to the surface when we've got somebody with a life-sustaining or life-serious illness. Limited social support, caregiver burden is our other risk factors. When we've got patients who are younger, that's a huge risk factor. So a patient who is 30 or 40 years old and has young children is at a much higher risk than a patient who is 80 or 90 and has adult children. Additionally, cultural and language barriers can pose a huge risk and are very difficult for them to navigate the healthcare system. And then sudden or unexpected decline. So families who haven't had time to emotionally prepare for this process. And I see this a lot of times with cancer patients. So if somebody has cancer, they are, you know, let's say that battle is 2 years long. They're actively fighting cancer for 2 years, but they haven't come to the point where they've faced the reality that battle might not be won. And so even though they've had this disease for 2 years, it can be a very sudden or unexpected decline for that family. And so it poses additional risk factors that they weren't prepared for. And then another big one is a history of loss. So if you've had multiple losses within a short period of time or traumatic deaths, it puts you at an exponentially higher risk for some of these challenges.
Thank you. And how can hospices identify which families are at higher risk? What are some strategies for assessing that?
Yeah, so integrating psychosocial care from day one is important. Making sure that social workers are going out there to assess patients and their families. One of the great things about hospice is that hospice looks at the entire family and the entire ecosystem. And so when we are assessing the patient, Medicare requires us to assess for socioeconomic needs and risk factors within the patient and the family at large. And so using standardized tools such as a bereavement risk assessment or the PHQ-2 or 9 or the Columbia Suicide Risk Assessment, those sort of standardized assessments can help us flag out patients who are at higher risk. Additionally, a lot of hospices will have these assessments built into their assessment. So they will have a checklist of risk factors and, you know, the nurse will go in and check off all of these things that are identified as a risk factor. And then as an interdisciplinary team, we come together and look at these things and say, what's going on with this family? What can we expect as their disease progresses? And what should we be looking out for?
And how should they be documenting this?
It's a great question. So building assessment tools into the documentation is really the key. It ensures standardization across all patients. So it means that we're looking at everything, even if we don't think we need to look at everything. Our documentation should always paint the picture of the current situation. I always tell clinicians that as a leader, I should be able to look at a patient's chart and know exactly what's going on with them and what's going on with the family and the environment. And so making sure that we are describing risk factors, we are noting interventions, and we are being very open with our communication style to the family and to our interdisciplinary team, making sure that we're documenting every risk that is there and what we're doing to mitigate that risk.
Thank you. And how can hospices address somewhat extreme situations in which there's, for example, a history of abuse or domestic violence or other hopefully rare circumstances?
Yeah, we say hopefully rare, but that's something that we definitely screen for with every patient. We look and make sure that there are no signs, symptoms, risk factors for abuse, neglect, exploitation from our patients. Safety is always a top priority for our patients and for our staff. And so making sure that we are looking at that first and foremost, we should be conducting private conversations with the patient and or caregiver whenever possible. As a social worker by background, I always used to go out and do my initial assessment with my nurse because she would take the family aside and do medication counts while I had a chance to privately talk with the patient and make sure that they felt safe in their home without telling the family, hey, I'm going to ask your loved one if they feel safe. I need you to step out of the room. It was a natural opportunity for us to do that. And so making sure that we're assessing for those things, following mandatory reporting requirements when necessary. So every healthcare worker is a mandated reporter, meaning that if they see something or hear something, they are mandated to report that. And making sure that we're coordinating with any community resources, such as domestic violence shelters, adult protective services, child protective services, all of those different agencies, we want to be able to be sure that we're tapping into them and utilizing them as resources, not just as a, I'm reporting this to you, but utilize them as resources. They're there to help you and to help your clients.
See, thank you. And who should be involved in addressing the family's emotional needs? Which staff or clinicians?
Yeah, so emotional support in hospice and in care is interdisciplinary. It should never be siloed. When we see it siloed, it's when we have an increased risk. So it works best as a team effort when we have social workers, chaplains or spiritual counselors, nurses, physicians or nurse practitioners, home health aides, and even volunteers as a part of that interdisciplinary team. They are the eyes and the ears for our leadership team, and they're the ones that are out there every day seeing these families. And so a lot of times when I would go out and see a family, I would leave the house and I was there with my nurse, and the nurse and I would say, did you see that? Or did you see this? Or what were your observations here? And we oftentimes picked up on things that the other one didn't. And so it just paints the picture of why having an interdisciplinary collaboration is so important, because we can be in the same room and see two totally different things. So having that interdisciplinary communication and collaboration is key.
And finally, what are some practical strategies that hospices can use to help the family through some of these issues?
Yeah, so one of the biggest things that I always tell our new clinicians is that we are seeing patients and family members in some of the worst days of their lives. And the biggest thing for us to do is to normalize that and validate those feelings. Let them know, you know, what they can expect. Give them education about anticipatory grief and anxiety, and let them know that all of those are completely normal reactions. Having frequent check-ins with the family. So in our practice, we have tuck-in calls or weekend rounding calls, and we have volunteers calling all of our home-based patients every week to make sure that they have everything they need for the upcoming weekend. They have supplies, they've seen all of their clinicians that they need to see. And if any needs come out of that, we're raising that red flag and letting our team know. We can also offer respite and community resources. So respite is a very underutilized benefit within the hospice realm, and it can really give family members a sense of relief to be able to recharge themselves and prepare themselves for, you know, the upcoming weeks and months ahead. Additionally, teaching coping skills can be huge. So our social workers and spiritual counselors can lead grounding exercises and relaxation techniques. We can schedule a volunteer to go out in the home so that the loved one can go to the grocery store or take a nap or a shower without fear of being interrupted or something happening. So teaching those kind of coping skills, assisting with those coping skills as well, is huge for an agency to do.
Margo, those were all of my questions. Again, I really appreciate the discussion and your insights. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. It's always a pleasure.
This has been the Elevate Podcast by Hospice News, a WTWH media publication. Thanks so much for joining us, and take good care.